So how did you come into this profession of mental health?
Well, it's personal to me. So my story really is what drove me and my family into talking about mental health and what are the needs. And it's not just mental health. Mental health, substance use, addiction, health issues. I mean, these were all kind of intersecting issues that affected my family and directly me. So starting with my own story where I, you know, started, you know, had struggling as a very young child with many issues. And, you know, I can tell you more deeply about that.
You arrived in Rochester as an immigrant.
That's right. So
from
so
which
my,
country?
So my family is from India. I'm born in Kuwait. And so when we came, which was in the early 70s, 72, we started in New York City and then came upstate to Rochester. And I started school in 75. And even prior to starting school, preschool and school age, I started to notice just the tension that people had with our presence. And what I mean by that is any of us that were people of color, I noticed had some real angst and tension with people who seemed to be saying things like, where are you from? We were, you know, in other words, it was always almost an assumption that we were not from around here.
You were treated as the other.
Correct, exactly. So there was this immediate othering that was happening. And so this idea that, you know, where do I belong, was an immediate question. And so that sense of, I don't belong here, I mean, that was a mantra of mine for many years thereafter. So
how bad did that get?
Well, for me, it got pretty bad. So there was adults that would say things like that, even to children, including myself at my local church, to kids in school that really carried that out in bullying and you know, not just verbal assaults, but also physical assaults. I was constantly basically having my guard up, whether it was at the bus stop, on the way to school, in the school, in the bathroom, or the coat room, or the classroom itself. So we were often finding ourselves fighting, and, you know, I defended myself eventually, but the message, you know, for me was, I got to keep my guard up, and this isn't a safe place. So, and I don't belong here, is really kind of the main drivers of how I operated. And then even going home at my own family's, you know, urging, trying to find a way to be Indian, and also trying to be a way to be this new kid in America, was really challenging. I didn't know how to be who I was, and so I started to even question whether my family wanted me around. And you know, so maybe I started to interpret their behavior. Even my mom watching me eat, I interpreted as her. Maybe she's poisoning my food. Maybe she's trying to get rid of me. Maybe they don't want me around. I was starting to hear voices at the nighttime when they were speaking that maybe they're plotting against me. Nothing they ever intended. They loved me, but I couldn't feel it. I stopped. It was starting to get disconnected.
So what led you out of that?
So that path continued for years with struggles in school, with struggles with other students, with teachers. I coped with things like using drugs. That was an avenue that worked for a period of time, and then that also stopped working. But then when that stopped working, I couldn't stop. So addiction now was something that I was experiencing. And even when I moved to another school, I found that experience continuing. I was struggling with, you know, hearing voices that other people couldn't hear. I was seeing things that other people wouldn't see. I was struggling at night with, you know, visions of things that were trying to invade my body. I couldn't, you know, I would wake up screaming as the only way to get rid of these images. And at one point it just said, nothing's gonna work. And I decided I needed to end my life. So suicide attempt was really kind of a major factor that occurred. So I was 15 years old. And after I, you know, came to in a hospital and my mom and my father are there, my mother actually, you know, I don't tell this story that much, but my mother was there. And, you know, I think I was in restraints and I just closed my eyes. And I remember just seeing all the things that I had done in my life that weren't me, that I didn't even know how to be who I was. I hated myself so much that, you know, I turned to my mother and I said, you know, in our language, you know, do you still love me? And, you know, she without hesitation said, yes, of course I still love you. And even as I remember saying it to this day, when I said it, I wanted to pull it back in my mouth because I thought the answer was going to be, of course I hate you. I didn't expect her to say, I love you. But even when she said it, there was a part of me that just wanted to believe it was true. And I closed my eyes and I continued to stay there. So these were kind of moments where a slight opening occurred and I was willing to believe a little bit more about that. Now, there's something else that happened. At the same time, my father was going to a church and he reached out to a man here in the city and finally said to somebody, because our culture, we don't necessarily reach out to people. We were keeping it to ourselves, even no matter how much people might have noticed. We weren't really, you know, we don't call 911. We don't, you know, there's a lot of things that we weren't doing to, because of basically fear of judgment. And we would get that judgment from other people and other systems. My father reached out to another man in his church and said, hey, my son's in the hospital. He just tried to kill himself. He's on drugs. He's on the street. I don't know how to reach him. And this man said two words that really changed my life and our lives. He said, me too. His son was also struggling. He said, we and a few other families are organizing together here in the city. And we've, even across the parking lot from Brighton High School, we've renovated a barn over there, an old horse barn with put ping pong tables and pool tables and couches, soda machine, and we've given it to the kids to support themselves in that environment. And while it was focused on young people coming out of drug rehabs and help giving them a safe place to stay in their addiction recovery, many of us had mental health and addiction issues. And it was interesting because when I went, my father said, maybe you want to try this. And I was still, you know, skeptical about anything because everything that I felt was going to be a challenge. But I went. I got out of the hospital. I went over there. And, you know, the story I tell is I opened the door and I remember, because I did walk into any place with that, do I belong here? I don't belong here. And finding the evidence of why I don't belong there. And I had my guard up. And as soon as I did that, I saw all kinds of people that were very different from me. Punk rockers, skinheads, hard, you know, all kinds of people that didn't look anything like me. And this one kid turned and looked at me and said, hey, you want to come over and play pool? And a smile on his face and a warmth that just made my guard drop so fast, faster than I could have possibly controlled it. And even without my control, I wanted it back up, but I couldn't bring it up. And I walked over and even I had really long hair down to my waist practically, as 100 pounds soaking wet. You know, I didn't even think I looked like somebody anybody would want around. And, you know, he invited me in and he even joked about my hair. He said, maybe you'll get a haircut one day, you know, and I would never have let anybody make that joke. But he made it and disarmed me, you know.
It's
quickly.
Amazing, isn't it? The most innocent thing, a simple thing you could say to someone that could change their life.
Yeah, and that's what happened. I mean, so from the Me Too, and now we have a Me Too movement, for example, that's extraordinarily made that point. But that was my family's story, and for me to have that, you know, welcoming from young people that didn't look like me, sound like me, talk like me, act like me, really reach across those divides towards somebody with similar needs, and then you know what they did next, and to get to your finally get to your question, answer your question, they offered me an opportunity to reach out to other kids at Hillside Children's Center, for example, and other places. But this first one where I just went out to a group of kids who are 8 to 13 years old, just like me, but they were locked in the facility, fighting a lot and struggling, and their therapist wondered if maybe talking with me would make a difference. And that was only 6 months later, in 1986. And sure enough, it did. I had a way, apparently, that got people talking. And, yeah.
So now you head the Mental Health Association in Rochester, and you come as someone with the experience of what it's like to be an immigrant in a community where you might not always feel welcome. You come with the experience of someone who's been bullied and the experience with someone who's attempted suicide.
Mm-hmm.
How does that inform what you want to do for this community? What has your experience told you about the help that you want to bring to people now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the lived experience that many of us bring, and it's not just my experience, but making that me story that I just told, at least even a glimpse of, into a we story is part of what happens when people are open about their lived experience and about what we've been through. So there's a what's happened that opens up a conversation about what we're trying to do. So there's a way that shows up there. So that way of being, that approach, is something that can be operationalized not just in relationships and in conversations that are healing, but also operationally in how you run organizations and how you create systems. And that's what I found, is that anything that I've ever done has really just been walking that talk and practicing these very basic principles that are about connecting, building relationships, asking what people want and need, asking, being in alignment with those things, creating a method for that to happen, and then getting it done and then delivering. You know, and when that happens, things change.
I want to switch gears a little bit because the national conversation about gun violence, often you hear talk about the need for better mental health screening, better access mm-hmm. to mental health services. What role do you think mental health should play when we're talking about gun violence and preventing gun violence?
Right. Well, so I'm glad you asked that. Right now, it's probably one of the most important conversations to have, because I believe mental health, just like every other aspect of community, has a hand in supporting our communities to address any public health crisis, violence being one of them. So I look at it from that standpoint. Everybody's got a role in it. So it's not about saying it's not us and kind of blaming some other segment of community to take responsibility for it, because that means I have nothing to do with it, and that's not helpful either. The other nuance to this, though, is that there's a tendency to go, oh, it's got to be something about mental health. And so when somebody chooses to shoot up a school and do something as incredibly volatile and traumatic as it is, it's human to want to have an explanation and to want to believe that those of us who are diagnosed with serious mental illnesses are people that you could, you know, kind of just, if we just watch them better, then it'll reduce violence. And that's the mistake. There's a myth around that we want to make sure everyone understands that if you try to invest in mental health services to reduce violence, you're not going to get the outcome you want. All the research, there's a researcher, Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University, who made it his career to look at the intersection between mental health and violence. And he also said, you know, 96% of the violence, including gun violence in the whole country, is not attributable to any mental health backgrounds, only 4%. And even that 4% is part of a community that's actually only a fraction of the 1% that we are, right, in terms of those diagnoses. So anyway, so I would say that, yes, we need to be in the conversation, but don't over-rely on screening or mental health diagnosis and capturing that kind of an issue to dangerousness. Because otherwise what will happen is a young person like me isn't going to be able to be open about hearing voices in school without being perceived as dangerous.
Even if someone who commits gun violence does not fit the clinical profile of, mm-hmm. of mental illness, mm-hmm. do you agree that they're suffering on some level that we somehow should, as a community, be able to do something about?
Yes, absolutely. So at the core of this is disconnection. So that so even in this most recent situation in Parkland, Nicholas Cruz was expelled from school and forgotten. There's an expel and forget approach in schools that needs to be dismantled. The disciplinary process, and Rochester is a great example of, we have a task force here on school climate. And the school climate task force is focused on restorative justice practices, restorative practices that actually do what you and I just talked about, which is create the vulnerability in the relationship, whereas a person who might have threatened another student or even acted against a teacher, there's a circle that forms about facing what I've done and also facing the challenge that occurred and really offering how I felt harmed and helping young people, even at 6 years old, learn how to resolve conflict. So the ability to learn how to resolve conflict, address anger, deal with issues that are, you know, unclear to me, how to ask questions, those are skills that we all need to make sure young people and also our culture, so it's teachers and everyone involved in the school. So that's why they call it a school climate task force, because it's everything. It's about relationship.
When you look at the profile of these shooters, they are often young men who feel isolated, who appear to be isolated. Is there something about the way our culture defines masculinity that would keep someone who is suffering or who needs help from asking for it?
Well, there's probably aspects of our culture which, you know, it's interesting. There's, you know, you try to talk about what's in the water as a fish who's swimming in the water.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to understand what what is impacting us. Exactly. Yeah. So that creates some consciousness about everything from violent messages, messages of invulnerability, or that I shouldn't ask for help, or how to really resolve conflict. These are all aspects that we can't ignore. Consent culture, I think, is another example of that. There's a variety of aspects of cultural learning that gets dismantled in some, and I don't want to say just industrial societies, but overall, it's something when we start to compartmentalize our lives this way, it gets harder to learn from things like my ancestral knowledge of Ayurveda or my, in Indian tradition, my family stays very close to that healing practice, which includes being honoring of what we put in our bodies or how we exercise or, how we meditate or how, whether we do yoga or not. These kinds of things are just the beginnings of tapping into aspects of our culture. So I think we could do more with that. I think there's a lot more to do there.